Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi guys, quick one before we get into the episode. This episode is sponsored by Zencastr, which is the production suite that I've used from the very beginning of this podcast. And if you're interested in starting your own podcast, hang around at the end of the episode for our 30% discount referral code. Thanks.
So our podcast is called Right and Wrong.
Are these your notes? These are your notes about what we're going to say?
Anything. Nailed it. It's a short answer.
So how many novels did you not finish?
Oh my God, so many.
It was perfect. What's she talking about? This is nonsense.
Ooh, a spicy question. I love it.
This is it, guys. The big secret to getting published is you have to write a good book. You heard it here first. Hello, and welcome back to the Right and Wrong podcast. Today, I'm joined by murder, mystery, horror, young adult writer, Amy McCaw. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for that introduction. I'm going to start using that.
Just whenever you enter a party.
Yeah,
or something.
Just whenever I meet anybody.
How are you doing? How's it all going?
I'm really good, thank you. It's really nice to talk to you at this point. A couple of weeks when my next book's coming out, so I'm just starting to think about what it's like, going to be like to go from being a debut author to slightly more experienced author. I still don't feel like I know what I'm doing, but
oh yeah, I guess you lose the title of debut author once your second book's out.
Exactly. So I'm not quite as shiny new anymore, but hopefully I'm growing and learning as an author.
You lose all the sympathy from the other people.
Yeah, that's it now.
But of course, yeah, your second novel, Mina and the Slayers, out September.
Yeah.
We will talk about it, but before we do that, let's go back. Let's go all the way back to the first one. Your debut, Mina and the Undead, whilst you're still a debut novelist. And even further back from then, because you started in this sort of industry, this community, as a book blogger.
Yeah, I did. So I went to YALC, the Young Adult Literary Convention, and did a workshop about starting a blog, and just spontaneously decided to start one because one of the publishers said to me, you absolutely should have a blog. You know more about YA books than just about anyone I know. And I was like, well, that's a big compliment. I'm going to try that. And yeah, I did that for quite a few years. And I honestly think that's one of the reasons why I got a book deal, because it just set me on such a good path and made me part of the community. And I think I learned so much, and I ended up pitching to my agent a few years later, also at YALC, where I learned about blogging. And then the following year, met my publisher there. So if YALC didn't exist, I may not have written any books, and we'll never know. For me, it's been amazing to be part of that community. And I think the support since I've become an author has been really lovely as well, because people have been there through that whole journey with me. They've talked to me about being desperate to be an author, sat with me at YALC, and then been to YALC and watched me be up on stage as an author. So yeah, that's it's awesome. Been nice to have people as part of that journey.
Yeah, you must have a really good sort of tribe around you.
Yeah, I have. I've got a little team that we call Team Mina with my publisher, and it's kind of people I've collected in sort of my group of friends along the way. Some that knew me right from the beginning of blogging, and then some that really liked the first book. So it's great that I've just got this group of people that are excited about content that I put out, and they help me share it. So it's been a real advantage to have a lot of bloggers in my corner. I would recommend it.
And have you sort of dialed back on the blogging since, you know, your book has come out and you've got the second book on the way?
Yeah, I have. So it was interesting. I got to the point in my blog where it was starting to feel a little bit like a chore sitting and writing it down. And I think as soon as something that's meant to be pleasurable becomes a chore, you've got to kind of evaluate it. And because of the pandemic, I was being asked to do all these virtual events in my book, and I loved them. I was like, who would have thought that I would actually enjoy being on camera and stuff? But I did. And I decided then that I'd start my YouTube channel. And then a little bit after that, I took the plunge and did TikTok. And I'm finding that, possibly because I've got a toddler and a job and I'm trying to write books at the same time, I feel like recording a short video is a bit more manageable and somehow seems really fun and invigorating again. So I'm still talking about and reviewing books, but I'm just doing it in a different way now.
Yeah. Okay. So more sort of, I guess the obvious thing about TikTok is it's very short. So if you to put a whole review in a TikTok is a sort of snapshot review.
Yeah, it is. And it feels like it can be quite quick and spontaneous. Like if I just think of a funny thing that I want to say, or like I realized I was reading 7 books at once accidentally somehow. So I just film that stack of books really quickly. And it just feels like I can create content a bit more easily rather than logging onto a blog, thinking about it, trying to remember, I feel like it just fits into my life a bit better this way somehow.
That's great. So you're still doing it, but it's different. You've kind of evolved it into something new.
Yeah.
What, this time, whilst you were blogging, whilst you were going to Yauk and sort of meeting all these people, were you always writing your own stuff in that time?
Yeah, so I used to be a teacher. I graduated from uni studying law, which was totally different from teaching. and then I did a teacher training qualification. And even from that time, I've got really early books. My first book was a vampire book, which I'd never let anybody read because it was terrible. And I didn't really send that out to anybody. But teaching took a lot of my time and energy. And about I carried on writing, but it was quite sporadic between holidays. And then I became a consultant about 5 years ago, I think now. And that was when I thought, actually, I've now got my evenings back. I've got my weekends back. I'm not marking anymore. And I just decided this is it. I'm going to do it. And I got a place on a mentoring program called Write Mentor. And I had to have the book finished by like a few months later to go in front of a panel of agents. So for me, that just kind of kickstarted everything, because as soon as you give me a deadline, I'm suddenly motivated and suddenly, you know, that you, because you could carry on revising a book forever. I'm sure it's the same with your podcast. Like, you could edit and tweak and think of more things you want to say. Just got to hit publish, haven't you?
Yes.
And that, yeah, that end point was really good for me, because it was like, I can do nothing now. It's out there. The agents have got it.
Yeah, so that
was great. And I think that although I love teaching, it was kind of, for me, I don't know how people teach and write books. There are some amazing authors I love, like Sue Warman is a school librarian and author. And I don't know how people do it because it's so all-consuming. It certainly was for me. But I think being a consultant just allowed me to get a little bit of a balance and find some time, you know, that I could actually be creative in.
Yeah, that's great. It's really nice to hear that you sort of, you don't necessarily have to give everything up. It's just, you know, you just find the right places to fit things as stuff moves around.
Yeah, and I think for me, I just have to be disciplined about it.
Was when you found this time and you started writing, was Mina and the Undead the first sort of full story that you wrote?
Yeah, so I'd queried other things. I'm trying to remember. I think Mina was the first thing since leaving my teaching job. It was the first thing that I felt really genuinely like this could be something. Other stuff, I did query agents, but without quite the same enthusiasm and kind of second guessing myself. And I think maybe writing things that I thought people wanted me to write. Whereas this book, I went to New Orleans in 2012 and just had this idea kind of simmering in my head for a couple of years. And then it got to a few years later and I was like, I need to write this book about New Orleans. It's still there kind of nagging at me. And I just threw everything I loved into it. And I was like, okay, vampires, serial killers, murder mysteries, it's all going in there. And I think having that passion about it, I've just realised then that that's what I need to do with every book. The thing I'm working on now is sort of a standalone alongside other things. And I'm still doing that same thing. I'm exploring all different stuff that I'm interested in and that's going to keep me going, because you have to edit it so many times. You've got to really, really love it, I think. And I really want to keep going back to it.
Yeah. The funny thing is, because I talk to a lot of authors who often when a book is about to come out, like in your case, or when a book has just come out, and it's funny because a lot of people say, what you don't realize is that, you know, you've spent a year or so writing the book and then the publisher's gone to edit it, and then once it's edited, there's this whole sort of like timeline where you kind of finished this book really like 1 or 2 years ago, and now people come on the podcast and then they talk about this book that they actually haven't worked on for quite a long time.
Yeah, it's been nearly a year since I finished writing it. I sent it to my agent last September, because my agent is really editorial, and it's one of the things I love about her among many. Mm-hmm. And she always does a first round of edits for me. So I know she asked for it beginning of September. So it has been nearly a year, but I did a lot of rounds of edits. I don't know whether it's because it's a murder mystery, whether I'm just that kind of writer, but I need to do a lot of checks to make sure the mystery, all the elements line up and everything's properly seeded. And it takes a lot. One day I'll try not writing a mystery to see if that takes any less rounds of edits. But yeah, for me, the last book, I only had a few months to write it because of the, like you said, the publisher's timeline. But then it took me like 8 months to edit it or something like that. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So as someone who does write murder mysteries, as you say, when you're sort of going to create a new story on a scale of, let's say, whimsically vague to like rigorously mapped out, how heavy is the planning?
whimsically vague. I get, so with Mina and the Slayers, my second book, there's kind of two main threads to it. Mina discovers that people a lot of people seem to be being murdered or being attacked in a way that seems like vampires are killing them. And she's working for the police and they stumble upon this. And similarly, she realises that somebody is also killing these vampires. So we end up with a Slayer storyline and a murder storyline. And it turns out that some of the murders have been done by a serial killer. So I do this myself. Initially, it was just the Slayer storyline. And then I was like, wouldn't it be fun if I added a serial killer? And it was fun, but it just meant I'd got two really big threads. I'd kind of got this story of the Slayers dealing with a huge vampire problem in the city and what was causing that. And then I've got this serial killer who's also taking people out as well. And Mina, of course, as she does, getting caught in the middle of all of it.
And where does the... So you say it's kind of whimsically vague in the planning kind of stage of it, and you grow it as you kind of create it.
Yeah.
Where does it kind of grow from? Like, do you come up with the characters first or the world first?
I mean, so Mina and the Undead, it's probably easy to talk about that because obviously by Slayers, although it was difficult still to write, the advantage that all of that was established. So the world, it was 1990s New Orleans still a few months later. It was the same characters with a few extras. So I think Mina and the Undead was when I really had to test my writing process. And yeah. I'll have to share the page at some point. I've still got this A1 piece of paper. I think it's a huge piece of paper.
A1?
No, it might be. It might be A2. I might maybe exaggerating. So but big. It is this huge piece of paper. It was an author called Laurie Hall Sanderson said that she did like a big mapping thing and I thought I would try it too. And it worked for me. So I just, I think I wrote in the middle, New Orleans Vampires. And that was the working title for quite a while. All kinds of things that I wanted to go in there. So I wrote things like bones and skulls, which made its way into one of the bars in the book. And I just had this really fun mind mapping process. And it was based on some of the local myths from New Orleans. So I knew I wanted those to go in there and that those myths would kind of bleed into reality because people in the city, it's really fascinating. They tell you stories about ghosts, like they believe in them, like, oh, my grandma sat next to a ghost on the bus, or I know somebody who saw a vampire. I know somebody who's a vampire. And for quite a lot of people, it's just completely different from living in Yorkshire. If I said that to people, they would not believe me. So that was kind of where I started, with just this vague sense of mythology. And I tried a couple of characters, and I started off writing a chapter without any planning, and it had two characters. One of them was a fortune teller and one of them was a guy, and they worked in this like horror house, and straight away I knew that there was this big mansion where people dressed up as horror movie characters. And even that just initial vague idea, that became a huge part of the book. So I think a lot of the early seeds make it into my books. But this main girl being a fortune teller didn't work at all, and somehow as soon as Mina was named after the girl from Dracula and her sister was named after Elizabeth Bathory, I thought, well, what kind of mother would name her daughters after like two kind of tragic, one horrendous vampire woman, one kind of vampire victim, but strong woman in her own right. And, you know, I won't give too much away about the book, but a very specific kind of mother names her children that. And it just grew from there. So I think it probably started with New Orleans, spanned out a bit into story and mythology. And then as soon as I got those characters, that propelled me through the book. And then the plotting was a big back and forth of, I'd plot, get really excited and want to write a bit, run out of steam, and then go back to plotting. And I think I still write a bit like that. It's all a bit chaotic. I think I've like the book I'm working on now, I think I've roughly plotted it out, and this is the most plotting I've ever done, but I already know I'm going to change so many things and go off on tangents. So I think even if I plot, it isn't going to end up being a plotted out book.
Yeah, that's kind of the beauty of first drafts though. And obviously everyone approaches them differently, but I've spoken to authors who the reason they kind of love doing what is often referred to as the vomit draft is because they know that nothing matters and like everything is up for grabs. Everything can change. Like aliens can come in at some point. It doesn't matter because you're just going to change it anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's maybe a personality type thing because I'm quite a perfectionist in terms of like if I'm working on a desk, I like it to be tidy. My house isn't tidy, but like my workspace and my thinking process, I think I hold myself to quite a high standard. So I remember Lainey Taylor saying that when she writes a book, it takes her so long because she has to review everything she's written before she can carry on. And I'm a little bit like that. Like I feel like if a scene's nagging at me and something's not working, I kind of have to fix it there and then. So my process isn't really that really fast draft. It's drafting but also editing at the same time. And if I know something's not working, I've written myself into a corner, I do go back and fix it, because otherwise I just think I'm going to keep going too far down that wrong path and then have to unpick it all later.
Yeah.
Now, some people who, my friend Mia Kushnir, she bullet points bits that, you know, bits of the plot that aren't flowing or that she just wants to come back to later. She writes a few bullet points and then carries on writing. I think, how freeing is that? But I just can't do it. I've tried. And I just, if a scene isn't working, I have to keep hammering it until I get it right. Or as close to right as you can in a first draft. I wouldn't carry on forever. I would eventually think, okay, I've got to leave that now.
Yeah.
But yeah. There is a lot of editing for me as I go along.
But that's what I imagine you're doing there is just you're taking something that would take time probably towards the latter part of that draft, and you're just bringing it forwards and doing it then, because presumably it will, you know, on your second sweep there won't be as much editing.
I think so, and I think partially because as my day job I'm a consultant and I do things like I write texts and I edit other people's texts. So I think I have quite an editorial side of my brain that I'm using all the time, and it's hard to switch that off when I'm writing.
Yeah.
So I think that's still nagging at me. It's like, come on, fix this. Come on, you can do better than that. That doesn't make sense. So I think this is why Mina and the Slayers was a real exception to the rule. I've never written a book in a few months. I had to really push through some of that doubt and some of that kind of editorial mind and just write it at some points. It was quite hard, actually, that.
Yeah, sometimes you've just got to face the fear, right, and just charge in and write it.
Yeah,
it's funny you mentioned your friend will just skip a section if she's finding it difficult, because I think it was, I don't know if it was Brandon Sanderson's lectures, but I know it's someone like that who was saying when they're writing and then they think about a very exciting scene that's going to happen later on, they will skip straight to it and write that scene then and there, because their energy for that scene right now is at an all-time high. And if they try and write something else, they're just going to be sort of going through the motions, kind of, because they just want to get to that later scene.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because I don't do that for a couple of reasons. I think first, I use scenes like that as a bit of a carrot. It's not too much of a giveaway, I don't think, to say there's a big carnival scene in my book. And I knew very early on that I was going to have this kind of big coming to blows of some kind. And I didn't quite know what it was going to be. I was really excited about writing kind of a spooky carnival. So I just held that in front of myself, come on, you're nearly there. But also I think if you're having to push through a scene and you're not excited about it, sometimes I have to take a minute, because I've written scenes like that where I'm like, this is going nowhere. I'm bored. I'm actually switching off as I'm reading this back. So is there a problem with this? So I think, I know quite a lot of other people do that. I think it was V. Schwaber that I saw at an event recently, that she, I don't know if she does it on all books, but on some she writes them out of order. And I don't think I could keep the thread of it, for one thing. I think I'd get really confused. But also, I like having that thing to push towards and writing chronologically, knowing where I'm going. For me, that is really motivating.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We're talking about world building and things like that. There's an interesting sort of thing that I think a lot of people often don't think about is you're now writing the sequel to Mina, which is obviously a sort of fantastical horror world.
Yes.
When you're doing that, you don't need to do the world building again, but, and this is probably something that I imagine comes up in the copy editing phase, are there points where you need to add in sort of reminders of how the story world mechanisms kind of work for the readers who might not have read the book for, you know, 6 months, 9 months, a year?
Yeah, a few people contacted me about that actually and said, is there a summary at the front of the book? Because I love that. And I was like, oh no, I didn't do that. I know some people do, they write a short summary of book one. I know a podcaster, Fictional Hangover, wrote a summary of my book. So I've been directing people to that if they want to read that. There's a really good summary out there. But the way I did it was I just tried to seed what I thought were the important takeaways from the first book, like, for example, characters that didn't make it, that played a big part in the book and left a lasting impression on the characters. They're mentioned in the first few pages just to remind the reader, this is what happened, this is why Mina's feeling this way. And I just try to remind people. And I really like Jim Butcher's books, which I'm forgetting the name of now. Stormfront is the first book, The Dresden Files, that's it.
Yeah.
And I've noticed with his books that he re-describes Harry Dresden's apartment every time in virtually the same way. And I was like, why does he do this? And yet, and then I get into the description, I'm like, oh, it's brilliant. I can totally imagine this place. I can imagine this floor layered with carpets and like tapestries all over the wall and a basement beneath that's really cold and full of, you know, his magical experiments and whatnot.
And I think that you do
need to do a lot of work to kind of remind the reader of this world, because for my book one of my favorite things is the world building and making it really evocative. And because it's New Orleans and it's the 90s and I'm trying to get this kind of spooky, and it's Halloween the second one, so I really wanted to capture what Halloween is like in New Orleans. So I'm kind of trying to establish that new world. It's no longer this kind of sultry too hot summer of the first book. It's now kind of a slightly cooler Halloween, where all the Halloween stuff's popping up around Mina and she's loving that side of it. So there's a real balance of re-establishing like the new world of the second book, creating some new interesting settings, but just reminding people, hey, this is what the Empire of the Dead Bar looks like, you've not been there for a while. You know, this is what these characters look like. Like I realized Mina's sister Libby and her girlfriend Della, quite a few drafts in, I thought, I haven't actually described them. I've just, like, you know, early on that they're a couple, they're being really affectionate with each other. But I didn't describe what they look like. And I know that some readers don't like that, but some people really need that kind of visual hook to imagine the character. So quite late on, I inserted a little bit of physical description of the two of them. And they're quite different characters in appearance as well. So I thought that contrast would be a really quick way of just reminding people, this is who you're dealing with. This is, you know, Libby Mina's older sister, her girlfriend who's slightly older again. And it just helps readers to kind of figure out where they fit, especially teenagers reading the book. I think it's quite helpful to know, well, Mina's close to my age and this is Della, who I might look up to. She's a couple of years older. It's interesting. There's a lot of, I think a lot of that comes later. The early drafts are just kind of figuring out the trajectory of the book, and then the later ones you kind of layer in details, but not so many that you're just weighing the reader down with backstory and description when they just want to get to the murders and the vampires.
Exactly.
And the kissing, you know, whatever floats the boat about the book. I think you've got to keep things moving.
When it comes to describing your characters, do you do that sort of technique of trying to give each character a very singular, distinctive quality?
I do and I don't. I think some characters, I imagine sort of a Hollywood actor, I have to admit, and sometimes I admit to it. So Lucas, who is quite a big character, was basically Leonardo DiCaprio in my head. So I said, he's like Leonardo DiCaprio in The Basketball Diaries. And then I explain what that is for people who have no idea what The Basketball Diaries is.
Okay.
I kind of use that as a shorthand for people who are movie geeks like me, but also it kind of tells you what sort of person Mina is as well, because she, like me and my husband play a game where we like to say that people look like Hollywood celebrities, and we kind of murmur it to each other when we first meet somebody. So we probably did that to you when we met you at Litfest. I'm sure you've got some look like. I can't remember who it was.
Kit Harington?
Yeah, maybe. Probably.
That's
somebody,
the one I usually
somebody handsome from Game of Thrones. Yeah, that's fine. We'll go with that. But yeah, so I think that I do things like that. Jared, as soon as I imagined him, I imagined him being really tall and kind of very slightly awkward and really fidgety. And that just became a real trait that whenever I imagined him, he's like messing with his hair, he's got his hands in his pockets. Whereas Mina, the main character, I think it's more because she's the narrator. It's about her internal world. So it's, like I said, it's the movie references, and it's everything reminds her of like actors and books she's read and stuff like that, which is a bit what I'm like. I don't think I intentionally give people a trait, but I think that as I'm thinking about it, each of my characters probably has something. Again, with Libby, it's probably more of a personality thing. And it's that creates the conflict between her and Mina, because they're quite different people and they've reacted to events in their life very differently. So for me, that was Libby's defining characteristic, her sort of kind of spikiness compared with Mina wanting to open up and talk, and Libby's like, go away, I'm holding you at arm's length. I think they all have something, but maybe not as obvious as this person has this particular mannerism, this particular appearance thing. I think it's all a bit of a mixture.
Yeah, there's a sort of silly name for that technique. I can't remember what it is, but it's things like, that person has red hair, this person has a moustache, that person always wears a silly hat.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it's, you can just say one thing and then immediately the reader knows who that is.
Yeah, maybe. As I'm thinking about it, yeah, I suppose Jared wears movie t-shirts as well. So maybe each person does have kind of a bit of a thing or several things.
Yeah,
it is useful. I'm a person who likes the visuals. I remember, is it Stephanie Meyer in Twilight saying that she purposely didn't describe Bella that much because she wanted readers to create a Bella and, yeah, you know, be the Bella if they wanted to be. But I think I like physical characteristics because I think I wrap all that up in what I'm imagining as I'm reading a book. So I try and put that in mind as well.
Yeah. Also, no matter how much you describe something, if you were to describe, if, you know, if I were to read a description of someone and you were to read a description of someone that was exactly the same, we would imagine different people.
Yeah, it's fascinating that, isn't it? I remember I did an interview last year about book one and somebody had like fan casted, or the person who interviewed me had picked people to look like the characters, and some of them, like the age was completely different. Like I'd specifically said this woman's in her 50s and he'd chosen this like young actress who had like completely different skin color and things, and it was interesting. He'd just taken the details and created this character that I'd not written, but, and he was like, oh, I love her, she's great, and he just created his own version of her, which I thought was really interesting because the book kind of does belong to readers, doesn't it? I can't, yeah, I've put that out there now. I can't kind of say, oh, actually, you know, she had different colour hair to what you think. You know, it's great if people want to impose their own kind of view and interpretation. Like, I find some characters a bit annoying, and some people say, oh, I really see myself in them, they're my favourite character. I'm like, I'm glad I didn't just tell you they really annoy me then.
It's cool, because it's such a collaborative, in like a weird way, it's actually a collaborative process between the author and the reader, I think.
Yeah, it is. You're being creative as a reader because you are using the author's words to conjure what you're seeing, and you're focusing on, some people will really latch onto the setting. Some people, I think, read my book just from like pop culture reference to pop culture reference, and that's what they're desperate to get to that next 90s reference and go, oh yeah, that reminds me of The Lost Boys, or, which I know is 80s, but you know, still. So yeah, and I think like somebody yesterday wrote a little thing that they'd just finished book two, and it was that, the pop culture, she just wanted more and more and more. Whereas other people would be like, what is she talking about? What is The Lost Boys? So yeah, I love that about books. I love that people, some people want more kissing, some people want less kissing. I've just got to put exactly the amount that I want in the book and just be okay with it, I think.
I have heard of, no names, but I have heard of editors and publishers encouraging more or less physical like kissing and stuff in books.
Yeah, it's interesting that my publisher and my agent both didn't really comment on that. I think they just let me go with the relationship stuff because I'd got a really clear vision for Mina and Jared's relationship, like how I wanted it to be, like start from friendship and kind of gradually build an intensity. And they seemed okay with that. It was the violence. Some of it they were like, it was a real serial kill. One particular bit, I remember my agent said, you might describe the flesh peeling a little bit too much. I was like, oh, is there too much flesh peeling? Okay, this is a teen book. Maybe I can rein the flesh peeling in a little bit. So yeah, it's interesting how certain age, some, I think certain publishers do want, they think that YA needs a romantic relationship. This was the thing of maybe 5 years ago. I think luckily we're moving away from that because not everybody wants that in a book. And I like it, but I like it to be part of a whole kind of complex story as well. Like I do read romance books, but it's not probably the predominant thing I look for in a book.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it, yeah, romance as a standalone genre offers, you know, a very a clear kind of cut thing, and that's what the fans of that genre want.
Yeah, and I like the fact that with, like, I think mine sort of falls into mystery but also has that paranormal romance feel, and I like that. I think paranormal romance has a bit of uncertainty because without, you know, giving too much away, it isn't necessarily guaranteed that every character will get everything they want. And especially being a series, you don't want to give every character everything that they've ever dreamed of straight away.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I need to make things difficult for them first and kind of hold them back and give them obstacles.
Exactly, yeah. Talking to a mutual friend of ours, Naomi Gibson, she often talks about her characters and her sort of goal with any story, the thing that she's creating is to mess with her characters as much as possible. Yeah. And she's like, if I don't know what to do, yeah, I just get one of the side characters to mess with the main character.
And Naomi's so lovely, and yet her books are like, I mean, every line of you is just such a twisty, dark, like provocative, thought-provoking book. And she's obviously, she's done that really well, that like pushing the characters, like, it's interesting, Lydia, the main character, like she goes on this journey of like walking along this knife edge, and you're just spending the whole time like, which side is she going to fall off? Am I going to be okay with what she does next?
Yeah, Yeah.
And it's great. It's really interesting ways that authors do think of how to keep their books interesting. I think I'm really protective of Mina, so I sometimes I have to remind myself she does need to have some adversity. She can't just cuddle Jared for, 300 pages.
Yeah, that's true. But as soon as Naomi had told me that, I was thinking back to the book. And then I realized that there are sections within, and I was thinking, analytically, as from a very crafty perspective, thinking, oh yeah, this is probably where it would have lulled. But I can see that you just brought in one of the side characters to cause problems.
Yeah.
And it works really well.
Yeah. I just throw a dead body in if I'm getting a bit bored. Like, who can be murdered next? Poor Mina, she finds so many dead bodies. I don't know how it happens.
Well, I had a bunch of much more technical questions, but this was far more fun talking about your process and the creation of Mina. So I'm glad we did this instead.
Oh, it's fine. I'm excellent at tangent. If you ever need a tangent, like linked to vampires and murder, I'm there for it.
Amazing. I'll bear you in mind whenever I need that kind of distraction. Before we get to the last question, I did notice on your Twitter that you are a voting member of the Horror Writers Association. What does that mean, really?
Not a lot, really. I joined the Horror Writers Association because Stephen King and various other notable people are in it, like Adam Caesar, and he wrote Clown in the Cornfield. And I thought, maybe this is kind of an association that I need to be a part of. And interestingly, you need to have, I don't remember the exact criteria, but you need to have done something like sold so many copies or made so much in advance or whatever, in royalties, to be a member. And I thought, well, actually, this feels like a kind of really nice club to be a part of. So I applied and got accepted. And the voting part of it is that you, once you're a member, you can vote for people to win their award. So you can be nominated. Great. So Clown in the Cornfield won it, I think, year before last. I can't remember who won it this year. Not me, obviously. But some incredibly notable author will have won it. And it just felt like a nice thing to be part of. I'm a member of the Society of Authors as well, but the Horror Association, it was something I'd heard Stephen King was in for years and years. I was like, when I write a book that's scary enough, like, this is what I'm going to do.
That's scary enough.
So, yeah, and I think it was just at the time, maybe I can take that out now, I've probably done more interesting things since then, but it just felt like a nice moment that I was part of something with authors like that.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I think it's cool as well. Like, you must feel very important to being a voting member.
Yeah, no, maybe that's why I worded it like that at the time. But yeah, that's just how they describe it. But yeah, it does feel nice. I think one of the best things about being an author, honestly, has been like meeting people like Naomi at events and just finding these like amazingly talented but people that are just completely on my wavelength.
Yeah.
That you get on with immediately just because they totally understand what it's like to be kind of a creative, kind of driven, focused on your book sort of person. I think it takes a very specific kind of person to be an author. And yeah, I've made loads of really good friends out of it. Authors like Cynthia Murphy and Kat Ellis were amazing authors and like really amazing people too. It's been lovely to be part of a community, especially the UK YA community.
Yeah.
I think is amazing. Like the last few years particularly, it just seems to have got so much talent, so many books that are doing really well, and finding lots of readers, which is really good.
Yes. Bookish people are very good at connecting with other bookish people, and I love going to events and just meeting people and talking to them, because it's so easy when you know that you have invested just as much of yourself into this kind of community and this and these creations as everyone else has.
Yeah, and it's a specific kind of person, isn't it, who loves being immersed in these fictional worlds and knowing, like you said, the kind of effort it takes to create these worlds and how hard it is to get published. I mean, you've obviously spoken to a lot of authors, like very few say, I got my book deal the second I went out on submission and I was given a 7-figure deal. Like, it's somewhere like that for many people.
Those are just the ones you hear about in the news. And all
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's really nice. I think as soon as you meet a bookish person, you know that there is going to be some point of familiarity and that you're probably going to be friends with them by the end of the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because you've been in one of the many trenches together.
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. Well, that is a lovely way to end the interview and lead into the much dreaded final question, which is, Amy, if you were stranded on a desert island with a single book, which book would you take with you?
Can I just say this is a terrible question? And when I saw it, I've only got one question for you. I was like, oh good, I can cope with one question. I saw the question, I was like, no, I can't cope with this question.
That's how I get you. I lull my guests to be like, oh, you just only have one question homework.
Okay, so I thought about it a lot and I thought, what is a book that if I was stuck on desert island would not only be useful, but I actually, you know, could entertain me for a while? And I went for The Beach by Alex Garland because survival techniques, you know, they have to survive on a desert sort of island. And I thought that that would be useful and practical. But also, it's a book. This is a random tangent, but bear with me. I used to go on a skiing holiday when I was a kid. And every year there was this new thing that was a trend. So one year it was like a new Game Boy would come out and everybody was playing Game Boys on this coach trip. And one year it was The Beach and all the adults were reading The Beach. And I think I was probably 13 or 14. I was like, I need to read this book. And I opened it and I was like, it's about drugs and people get killed and stuff. And it was such a like defining moment for me. I learned so much from that book as a teenager. It really opened my eyes. And I've read it so many times since then, and it's just so multi-layered and interesting. And it's just, it's a snapshot of this guy Rich's life. And you realise as an adult that he's actually a person who is just like falling apart. Yeah. And so many things are going wrong for him. And he's got this kind of imagined world and this real world of things that are happening to him. And then they cast Leonardo DiCaprio in the film, which is amazing.
I knew it was coming.
But yeah, another Leonardo DiCaprio moment. And I love the film, but it's a completely different thing from the book. If you like the film, you need to read the book because it's just got so many layers to it. Have you read The Beach?
I've not read it. I have seen the film, so I'm one of those people.
I think you would like it. It's very interesting. It's different. Richard is a complete nerd like me who loves computer games, also like me. And there's just so many beautiful details. There's this scene where he's talking about the real stars and comparing them to the stars he had on his ceiling back home, the plastic sticker stars. So, of course, I immediately bought plastic sticker stars and put them on my ceiling. And it's just so like, you know, those books that are really evocative and they just take you to a place. So I think if I was going to take a book to a desert island, Richard kind of transports you to this beach in Thailand and he transports you to his home back in England that he sort of misses but sort of doesn't. It would be a great book. I think I could last for quite a while on the beach.
Well, that's great. It's amazing just hearing that little anecdote from you, how connected you seem to that book and how big an impact it seems to have had on you.
Yeah, it did. There've been other books, like there were other contenders, like Daughter of Smoke and Bone by Lainey Taylor, I think had one of the best reveals of a YA book ever in it to me. I won't say too much more to spoil it. But you know, a book that makes you go, what? What? And you reread it again, and you're like, yes, that really did happen. Wow. So that book had a massive impact on me because I just think she's a tremendous author. And there've been others. Like I was thinking, oh, can I actually live without a Kendara Blake book? Like Anna Dressed in Blood is a great horror that really kept my attention, but I was thinking like long term The Beach has just been a book that's like you said, it's had such a lasting impact on me. It's probably not the best book ever written, not a book that everybody would love, but it's kind of featured in my life at various points just so that I feel like I would need it along on the journey with me.
Yeah, brilliant. I love that. Well, thank you so much, Amy, for coming on the podcast and sharing your knowledge and experience and a sort of deep dive into the creation of Mina and how you approach writing as a whole. It's been really fun chatting with you.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it as well. Sorry about all the tangents. You enjoyed them as much as I did.
Not at all. I loved it. And for anyone listening, if you want to keep up with what Amy's doing, you can follow her on most of the socials at YA_MySkin. Or on TikTok at Amy McCaw Author, or you can head over to her YouTube channel, which is just Amy McCaw. To make sure you don't miss an episode of this podcast, follow us on Twitter at Right and Wrong UK or on Instagram at Right and Wrong Podcast. Thanks again to Amy and thanks to everyone listening. We'll catch you in the next episode. Thanks for hanging around until the end. If you're interested in starting your own podcast but aren't really sure what that looks like, I can't recommend Zencastr enough. It's so simple to host, record, and download your podcast with, and it even has a built-in transcription AI. It functions entirely in the internet browser, which means all your guests have to do is click on a link and they'll be brought into the conversation. If you click on the link in the description, you'll get 30% off the first 3 months. All you have to do is click on the link in the description. Thanks again for supporting the show, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.